I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, whose fault is it that Americans are scientifically illiterate? But first, today, President Obama announced what he called a new missile defense architecture, dropping the land-based Eastern European defense system that so angered the Russians. That system, first announced during the Bush administration, was to be based in Poland and the Czech Republic, and it was supposed to defend against Iran's long-range intercontinental missiles. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who followed the president today, said Iran's short and medium-range missiles now pose a greater threat, and the new system will better address that.
Those who say we are scrapping missile defense in Europe are either misinformed or misrepresenting the reality of what we are doing.
Jonathan Marcus is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent in London. Jonathan, do you take this all on face value, that there's a better system that's being built, or do you think there's something else going on here?
Well, I think what we're essentially seeing is a recasting of America's missile defense plans. If you like, it's the Obama administration trying to show that it's a scientifically literate administration itself. It's looked at the intelligence evidence. It's looked at the plans, the way Iran is developing its weapons systems. And it's come to the conclusion that it's the short and medium range missiles, many of which Iran already has, that are the threat here and now. The idea of the previous system was to defend against intercontinental range ballistic missiles, which I don't think anybody thought Iran was going to get any time soon, except for the Bush administration. So I think it's a recasting of the plans to deal with a real threat that exists now, and importantly, using technologies that are tried and tested, the standard system, the Aegis radars on specially equipped warships. So something that will work and something that will deal with an existing threat.
Well, what about the diplomacy or politics, if you will, here? President Obama made a point today to say that those loud Russian concerns about the previously proposed land-based system that was planned for Poland and the Czech Republic were unfounded, but he has still shelved the plan. And it's well known that the U.S. wants Russian support when it comes to Iran's suspected nuclear program.
Well, indeed. I mean, one of the byproducts, one of the collateral benefits of a recasting of the scheme is obviously to present the Russians with something that they should see as less threatening. And we've already heard quite positive responses from the Russians. The question is, of course, whether those positive noises are going to be turned into some practical assistance for the Americans. It should help smooth the way to a new strategic arms agreement between Moscow and Washington. But of course, you point to Iran. The crucial thing that America wants from the Russians is more help in pressuring Iran to give up its controversial uranium enrichment program. And so far, one has to say, one hasn't seen much sign that Moscow is willing to come on board there.
Yeah, well, today's announcement drew immediate criticism from members of the Bush administration. John Bolton, who was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, said this was a concession to the Russians with nothing in return. But what's been the response in Eastern Europe?
There, I think the response is going to be ambivalent. Two things. I mean, first of all, opinion in the countries that were going to host elements of these systems, the Czech Republic and Poland, was divided. Some people were opposed to the systems. They thought it put them in the front line. It was unduly antagonistic towards the Russians. Others, of course, saw the hosting of these systems as a way of underpinning U.S. support for democracy in those countries, and indeed protecting them as part of the NATO alliance against the Russians. I think there will still be those two threads running through Eastern and Central European responses. But, you know, there is, in the intervening weeks and months, there has been a growing sense, I think, in a number of Eastern and Central European countries. You saw this with the letter that a number of former presidents of the region sent to Mr. Obama some weeks ago. There's a feeling that this administration just doesn't get the problems of Eastern and Central Europe, that they've moved on to Asia, the Middle East, to dealing with China and so on, that they think that Europe is done business. So I think to the extent that this new system deals with real practical threats that could indeed threaten European territory, they will welcome it. I think they'll also be pleased from the very clear statement that Mr. Gates gave that European security was still a preeminent concern for the Americans. I think where the diplomacy may have been a little bit less sure-footed is actually kind of alerting the Czechs and the Poles, whose governments had gone out quite a long way in investing their own political capital in these schemes, in backing these schemes. They may not have given them perhaps sufficient warning of something of a shift in US policy. But I think, you know, views in Eastern and Central Europe will be mixed, but there is the potential here for strengthening the relationship between these countries and Washington.
Jonathan Marcus of the BBC, thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Well, remember when people who built missiles or spaceships were like rock stars in the 50s? Every kid with a bottle rocket wanted to be one of them. That changed in the 60s, in part because Americans connected science with the military. But Chris Mooney says we can and have to be a country of science fans again. Mooney is the author of The Republican War on Science that was a bestseller during the Bush presidency. His most recent book, co-written with Marine scientist Cheryl Kirshenbaum, is Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. We've all heard the stats. Only 52% of Americans know that stem cells are different from other cells because they can grow into other cell types. 45% of Americans think the world is less than 10,000 years old. The authors spread the blame around, but a large part of it lands on scientists, specifically scientists who are strident atheists. That's caused quite a stir. Chris Mooney joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
You've bitten off quite a chunk again this time. So make your case further. Why is it such a problem in your mind?
I think that the reason that we're so concerned about people not knowing enough about science and not being engaged with science is because it impacts policy in the future. We've got science policy issues now that we're not handling well, like global warming, and we've got many coming in the future that we're not going to handle well unless we know more, unless we follow it more.
It's amazing when you think how much science has advanced and is a part of our lives, everything from computers, which everyone uses, to stem cell research. I mean, you make more of the list.
Well, yeah, there are stem cells. That issue has been at least partly resolved by the Obama administration, but there are going to be all kinds of issues in biotechnology, bioethics, regenerative medicine, neuroscience. All these things are constantly revolutionizing what we can do with life and how we might be able to change it and manipulate it. There are going to be all kinds of bioethical issues that arise that we're not going to be ready for.
Well, and as you point out, you take us through recent history. There are many more scientific issues that we should be concerned about now than there were post-World War II, when scientists were said to have saved the world with innovations and kids were out setting off bottle rockets. They wanted to be scientists. They had entree at the White House. Then that was lost in the 60s. Then Carl Sagan brought science back into favor.
I think Carl Sagan was an incredibly powerful figure in the 70s and 80s, especially when it came to drawing attention to the space program, which had, you know, reached its peak when we landed on the moon, and then people got less interested in it. Sagan sort of brought it back. And he also combated the president, Ronald Reagan, on some pretty important things relating to science, such as the viability of missile defense and Star Wars.
Well, and people liked him.
Yes, they did.
Well, and here's where it starts to get into kind of a kerfuffle. Because you seem to be saying that scientists need to be more likable, like Carl Sagan was. So that's sort of the perception. What is your intent?
I wouldn't put it quite like that. First of all, there's a heck of a lot of likable scientists, and I know many of them, and I adore them. What I think I would say rather is that the world of science, for all the wonderful things that it has done in terms of creating technology and innovations that not only, you know, improve our lives but have made this country wealthy, what they haven't prioritized as much as the innovations and the knowledge is bringing along the rest of the public and having them share in. And it's not just their fault because we have poor education and we have a lot of other problems, but I think it hasn't always been a priority, so we're trying to light a fire a bit under the scientific world.
Well, and you have, there have been flames, and we'll get to that in a second. But you cite British author C.P. Snow's 1959 comment as sort of your basis for this thinking. He said there are two cultures that scientists and humanists not only failed to communicate, they disdained each other. You take that further. You quote John Brockman, a literary agent for many science authors, as saying that there's now a third culture. Authors like Steven Pinker, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, who are communicating with people. People are buying their books. People are loving these scientists. But in your mind, they're making a mistake. What is that?
Well, some of them are making a mistake. I mean, I wouldn't knock popular books. But I think with someone like Richard Dawkins, who we criticize, he does reach a lot of people.
Richard Dawkins' book is The God Delusion.
Yeah, he does reach a lot of people, a huge number of people. He sold millions, at least over a million of God Delusion. Maybe as many as Sagan, although I don't think as many as Sagan. But the problem is it's done in such a confrontational way that I believe it just polarizes a culture war. And I don't think that it turns much of America towards science, especially the part of America that has, it thinks, religious reasons for being against science.
Well, here's what you write. You write, although they have made great contributions, these third culture authors, they've generated a lot of excitement about new areas of scientific research. You write, there's also an occasional undercurrent of arrogance and superiority that's led them into less constructive directions. Their frequent attacks on religious belief, perhaps the most damaging. Well, as you know, there have been some responses to that. P.Z. Myers, for one, who's mentioned in the book, he's outraged. He wrote on his blog, wait a second, you, Chris Mooney, are asking for media-savvy scientists, and then are you telling them that they should just hide their true beliefs about God or just bow to the will of the people?
Well, we're not saying that anyone should hide their beliefs, and it turns out that there's a long tradition of debating and advocating atheist positions goes back hundreds of years. And Carl Sagan himself was a questioner of religious belief. We're talking about the tone in which you do it. We're talking about tolerance, and we're talking about civility. And any intellectual debate should be conducted in those terms on any topic. And the critique of the new atheism, as epitomized by Richard Dawkins, and his followers like P.Z. Myers, is partly a critique of tone and the way that they denigrate all kinds of believers, lumping them into a category and putting down their intelligence.
Well, just browsing online, you know, people are saying that Richard Dawkins, in his book *The God Delusion*, portrays Carl Sagan as more of an agnostic. Would you say that's true? That Carl Sagan was just not sure. He just wasn't willing to say for sure. How would you put it?
Carl Sagan was not religious, and he made the case for atheism in a series of lectures. And in those lectures, he very powerfully interrogated the reasons for believing in God and rejected them. But what he didn't do was put people down. And he actually talked about how we need to work with the religious on areas where we have common ground, like nuclear arms control, which is what he cared about. That's the same position I have. Mm-hmm. I'm not personally religious, but I want to work with people to achieve shared goals. So the critique here is that if you're attacking people's beliefs and putting them down, then how can you form common cause with them on very important issues that we have to address as a people?
But do you think that Carl Sagan, you know, and you seem to be bemoaning, you know, we don't have the Carl Sagan, do you think he really would be effective today? When he was effective, you didn't have the Christian right that was as strong, that it was as networked. You didn't have the internet sites, and you didn't have the heat.
He took a lot of heat, though, from Reagan's defenders when he battled with them. I don't think that the heat was quite the same. And the media, as you mentioned, is vastly different. So things are different, but assuming that you have someone with that level of prominence weighing in, as Sagan would have, very heavily on climate change, just the kind of issue he would have taken up, I think it could have made a huge difference.
Well, but just one last thought, though, from P.Z. Meyer. Do you see his point that, hey, wait a minute, instead of, you know, us trying to work with these people, what about also laying the blame at the feet of the religious institutions that are responsible for this illiteracy?
Oh, no, I mean, I don't think that that's wrong at all. Religion is one of the central reasons that we have a block between science and American society, because there's this huge swath of religious America that rejects evolution, rejects modern knowledge. The question, though, is how do you deal with that? Do you crusade at people's faith, or do you tell them, which happens to be true, that they can actually have religion and also accept evolution in their lives? I think it's a much better approach.
Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, will have more with Chris in a minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Chris Mooney, co-author with marine scientist Cheryl Kirschenbaum, of the book Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. They say scientists should be more like the late populist Carl Sagan. But Chris, we remember that many of his colleagues didn't take him seriously because of his popularity. And you're taking a lot of heat now for saying that some scientists are still elitists. You say one of the reasons people are uninformed today is that scientists who are atheists are so strident about it and dismissive of people who believe. You point to E.O. Wilson, this is the Harvard biologist, as an example of a different kind of atheist who reached across the aisle to form a very successful alliance with Christian conservatives to fight global warming based on the fact that they both, you know, whatever they happen to believe the Earth needs to be saved.
absolutely in the Sagan tradition, and that's the kind of thing the science world needs to be doing. So the critique here is that if you're attacking people's beliefs and putting them down, then how can you form common cause with them on very important issues that we have to address as a people?
Well, let's get to the other culprits. Mm-hmm. The media. Two-thirds of the number of newspapers with science sections has shrunk by two-thirds in the last 20 years. Our Boston Globe here lost their terrific science section. CNN dismantled its science bureau. What do you do about that?
We need to convince media executives that people still want, which I think they do. They still want science coverage. This is not boring. This is not just a special interest that we can do away with.
But do they have to dress up the coverage? And this is also where you've been criticized in comparing science coverage to Hollywood and admonishing scientists that they forget they have to have a story to sell. And that's been offensive to some people. You know, why do we have to dress it up so much? I mean, people should be interested in stem cells. We shouldn't have to sell that story.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, I wish that one didn't have to tell a story in this way. I wish that, someone in the media just did it for you. But the reality of the media situation we're dealing with is that if you're not out there, communicating, then either your story is not going to be told or someone you don't want telling it's going to tell it. Someone who attacks the science, someone who undermines the science for a political reason. Those people have tended to be much more effective communicators than scientists themselves.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because there is a very organized effort to tell that side of science.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be making this case if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, just how much the scientific community loses the communication battle. And something like climate change or evolution would be great examples, where you have think tanks, well-funded, they employ people who have intellectual chops, although they might not be putting out good information, but they're good, they're convincing. And they go out and they do this full-time.
Name some.
There's Mark Morano, who used to work for Senator Inhofe in the Senate, and now he's got his own website, Climate Depot, and he is out there just putting out all this misinformation about global warming all the time. And there's nobody that I can think of in the world of science that exists as the equivalent of the counter Morano. There's some people who try, but the world of science, the incentives are all against this, whereas in the world of, special interests, the incentives are all for this. You need this because they privilege communication above everything else.
Well, and you also fault the media, mm-hmm. Present company, I'm sure, included, for feeling that they have to be fair, that if you do a story on global warming, you have to throw the guy in there who says there is no global warming.
Mm-hmm.
That's hopefully shifted in the last few months. But you say that's been part of the problem.
Oh, yeah. So the scientists wouldn't have to work at this as hard if you had media gatekeepers who ruled out misinformation and didn't let it dominate the news. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened in many cases. In general, when you're losing science journalists from the media, you're losing your defense against misinformation, right? Because that's what they're best at.
Right. And then finally, leadership. You point to Representative Vernon Ellers of Michigan, one of three physicists in Congress who describes having to rush to the floor to prevent fellow members from killing science programs they don't understand. One example is they thought that game theory research involves sports. By the way, and game theory is what?
Game theory is a field of economics that's been applied also to biological science.
And so there was some research being funded by Congress, and they were fighting against this research into sports games. He has to rush down and stop this.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the leadership missing in your mind?
Well, we've got a lot of people running things who don't know anything about science. And our argument here is that members of Congress really need to realize just how important scientific knowledge is to decision-making today. They killed their scientific advisors in 1995. The Gingrich people did away with them. We have very few people in Congress with scientific expertise, and we have very few people who are really even open to hearing it. So that's a huge problem. One of the things we argue for is that scientists should be running more for public office and should be holding these positions. Our ideal is the crossover scientist who takes scientific knowledge out into the society, and that's one particular place in which they can do it.
Well, and you say that with President Obama in the White House, we certainly have changed an attitude in a huge way towards science. The Bush administration, as you made clear in your previous book, the Bush administration was hostile to science. But you're not thinking, oh, it's all solved now.
No, because even though President Obama has said all the right things and done some of the right things with respect to science, you don't fix a problem as big as America's relationship with science just by changing who's in the White House. You might have a scientific Washington and still have an unscientific America, basically, and that's what I would argue. The president can't erase the trends in the media. The president can't erase creationism. It's bigger even than the president.
What are your solutions besides dreaming for a Carl Sagan?
I think that we need to be fixing science education, right? We haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah.
So science education in U.S. schools is in a dismal state. I think that we need to be waking up the university community and the scientific research community to get them to engage in much more outreach endeavors across the board. We should be, you know, getting people who are trained in science at a high level, and not all of them. Many of them are continuing to be doing research, but they should be going into schools. They should be going into, you know, careers in the educational program. That some of them should be going to work on Capitol Hill. And you go through all of society, you need scientists sprinkling out everywhere.
Chris Mooney, his book is Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. He wrote it with marine scientist Cheryl Kirshenbaum. Chris, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been great to be here.
Okay, quick note. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld, now plays himself on HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm. If he brings the Seinfeld gang together on his new show to talk about a fictional reunion, does that count as a real reunion? That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. You've probably done it, taken your eyes off the road to look at a map or a GPS or talk on the cell phone. A woman in Maine was seen driving through a toll booth while watching the Gilmore Girls on her laptop. Well, if that woman had caused an accident or committed a traffic violation while doing that, she'd possibly also face a penalty of up to $500 for distracted driving. 18 states plus the District of Columbia have passed laws against driving while texting, but Maine's new law targeting distracted driving is the country's first of its kind, and later this month the U.S. Department of Transportation will look at it at a two-day summit on the dangers of distracted driving. Lieutenant Chris Groton is with the Maine State Police in Augusta. Lieutenant, first tell us what the law says and what will it cover?
Well, Robin, what this law says, and Maine has used a little bit of a unique approach here, is if somebody is engaged in something besides driving, if they're distracted by any other activity that's not necessary to the operation of a motor vehicle, and there's a negative result, if they commit a traffic violation like speeding, following too close, running a stop sign, or they're involved in a crash, then there's an additional sanction, and the violation is failure to maintain control over a motor vehicle.
So, to be clear, you can't stop someone as an officer because you see them applying their makeup. It has to be after there's some sort of accident or a violation.
That's correct. This particular law doesn't outlaw any particular device, and it doesn't outlaw any particular activity. What it says is that if you can't do those things safely, then there's an additional sanction and there's a penalty associated with that.
Isn't it difficult to sort of define, first of all, operating a car? Because somebody might say, in order to drive my car, I need my GPS.
Absolutely. And that was one of the considerations that the legislature reviewed as they looked at a number of different initiatives to ban devices and ban certain activities such as texting. What you find is that there's no end to the list of distractions. There are things that we all accept are part of driving. And reaching for a CD or programming a GPS or dealing with children in the back seat, those are all very customary, ordinary things that in and of themselves may not be dangerous. And what Maine is saying is if you can't do those things safely, then there may be an additional sanction if you commit a traffic violation or you cause a crash.
Well, now the second question is, and again, you decided to go broader instead of just focus on a cell phone or texting. But isn't it hard to prove? I mean, if you come across an accident and you haven't seen that person, you know, searching in their purse or, you know, on their iPod, how do you know?
It is difficult, and that's really one of the inherent challenges that come with this type of a policy. And it requires us to rely on witnesses, requires us to rely on operator statements. There are other times when simply the evidence that's presented during a motor vehicle crash investigation starts to lend itself to the belief that there's something else going on. There's a reason why somebody ran into the rear end of a car and never even tried to brake. There are times when it requires additional work, and we have had fatal crash investigations in Maine where our troopers have gotten court orders and researched phone records and discovered that someone was texting for a period of time just prior to the accident or perhaps even during the crash event.
Well, the law's been in effect for a few days there in Maine. Have you written any citations?
I personally had an experience on the way home the other evening, and it was a motorist traveling at 86 miles an hour and following too close, and actually watched the person drift off the side of the road twice. And when I stopped the vehicle and interviewed the operator briefly, she was quick to say, yes, I was on the cell phone and wasn't paying attention. And the goal is really to send the message that we're concerned about this. This is something that is responsible for about a third of Maine's crashes. So, 15, 16, 17,000 crashes a year is important. That's significant. We hope to prevent this and get the message that when people are driving, driving needs to be their primary focus. And as we look around the country and you look at the impact of distracted driving on a national level, it's startling. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in Virginia Tech did a study, and they've estimated that distracted driving is a primary contributing factor in about 80% of all crashes in the nation. You're talking about almost 5 million crashes annually.
Lieutenant Chris Groton with the Maine State Police in Augusta, Maine. They've just passed the Failure to Maintain Control of a Motor Vehicle Law targeting distracted driving. Lieutenant, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, the federal government may have kept the nation's housing sector from collapsing, but how long can they prop it up? That's in about 3 seconds, here and now. The Commerce Department said today that more homes and apartments began construction in August than in July. That's another sign, along with an increase in the sale of new and existing homes, that the housing market is stabilizing. But the bump in sales is attributed to low interest rates and an $8,000 tax credit to first-time buyers. That's expected to lapse in November. So the question now is, can the housing market make it on its own without government support? Joining us is Wall Street Journal reporter Deborah Solomon. Her recent article was titled No Easy Exit for the Government as Housing Market Savior. Deborah, I said the tax credit was expected to lapse. It's slated to lapse. We're not sure if it will. Let's start with that. It's up to $8,000 for individuals making up to $75,000 and for couples earning up to $150,000. So did it get those people to buy homes?
Oh, definitely did. There are estimates out there anywhere from 350,000 to 400,000 home sales above what would have happened absent the tax credit. It's definitely pushing people into the market. The question is whether it is just stealing them from future years. In other words, if you're a home buyer or a potential home buyer who was thinking about buying a home in 2010, 2011, you see the potential to get an $8,000 tax credit and you think, well, I'm going to buy it this year. That's great. But when the tax credit runs out, it's basically stealing demand from future years. Right. And so there's a concern that demand is going to fall off once that credit expires.
Well, the debate that's emerging seems a lot like the one that we heard about cash for clunkers. The tax credit for home buyers expires November 30th. And the question is, as you said, is the housing market sustainable? So tell us a little more about the debate. Who's arguing to extend it and actually expand it? And who's speaking against that?
Well, it's interesting. This is a tax credit that in other times probably would get great support, but we're at a moment now where the budget deficit is a huge concern and every penny is being watched pretty closely, both by Republicans and Democrats. The Obama administration, which included the tax in the stimulus bill that was passed earlier this year, hasn't said whether it wants to extend it or expand it. People are saying privately that, it'd be great to have it, but that there are bigger issues out there like health care that need to be paid for, and so this is one of those things that's going to prompt a political fight in Congress if they do seek to extend it. A lot of economists who say that it should actually be expanded not just to first-time home buyers, but to all buyers, but that would come at an even bigger expense than what we currently have, which is the Congressional Budget Office had estimated this was going to cost about $7 billion, and some think it actually is going to cost more like $15
billion. Right, and the National Association of Realtors also wants to expand it. They want to make it for everyone, not just first-time buyers, and also make it a $15,000 credit, because this has been terrific for them. But as you said, is it sustainable? Well, home buyers you spoke with, including Jonathan and Annie Swinton, they bought a first-time home in a suburb of Salt Lake City, said it was the tax credit, but also the low interest rates that made them buy. Now, the low interest rates are created by the Federal Reserve holding up Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the lenders, by the Federal Reserve purchasing, buying up their securitized mortgages. But the question is, can the Fed do that forever?
Well, no, they can't. And I mean, the tax credit, you're right, is just one piece of this. There are so many things that the government is supporting right now. Everything from buying these mortgage-backed securities, which helps drive down interest rates, to basically controlling Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac raising the so-called conforming loan limits, which is basically the size of the loans that are backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the tax credit. There are so many different things that are girding the housing market, and they all have one thing in common, that is that they come from the federal government. So it's really going to be hard to sort of untangle any of these. There's a lot of concern that if you pull one of these threads, that you're basically going to undo, sort of the cloth that they've put around the housing market. And the housing market, it doesn't exist in isolation. It is what's helping the economic recovery that we're seeing. And there's concern that if you start to roll back some of the support, you're going to jeopardize some of the progress that we're seeing and potentially plunge us back into a recession.
And just to underscore how much the Fed is doing, we understand you report they're buying up $30 billion a week in these mortgage securities, and they plan on doing it until they've spent $1.25 trillion.
That's right. And what they're doing is they're trying to basically soak up supply of these securities, and that drives down the yields and makes it less expensive for banks to basically loan to each other. So they drive down the interest rates on mortgage rates.
By the way, just a quick question here. After the economic collapse a year ago, there was all sorts of talk of getting rid of these mortgage-backed securities because they were so dangerous. They included subprime loans or bad loans, and they were so hard, as you say, to untangle. Well, it feels like we couldn't possibly do that when you see how integral they are to the Fed propping up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah, I mean, the secondary market is really important, and one of the reasons it's important is that, you know, people don't want to take risks on a 30-year loan. I mean, you know, it's a long investment, and most banks are looking for profits much more quickly. So what they do is they break these up into shorter-term securities and sell them to investors, which is really the only way that you and I are able to get a mortgage. So they're pretty integral to the functioning of the market. What's going to change is that they won't be packaging such risky loans with non-risky loans and selling them all as a non-risky bundle, which is what the problem was before.
Well, the overall effect of all of this is staggering. You report that more than 80% of all mortgage loans made this year depended at least in part on some government support. And you spoke to Denver homelender Peter Lansing about this. What did he say?
He's a free enterprise guy, a free market guy, but right now he considers himself a government contractor. A lot of mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers basically are depending on the government for their business. It's not just Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's the Federal Housing Administration, which guarantees loans. If you want to understand just how much the government is supporting the housing market, look at the area where they haven't aimed their fire. That's called the jumbo market, basically big loans for rich people, people who want to buy a house for over the conforming loan limit. In some areas, it's not that much money. The conforming loan limit in some areas, most areas, is $417,000. In higher cost areas like Washington, D.C., it's about $729,000. But if you look at the ability to get loans above that amount, it's non-existent. I mean, you can get a loan, but it's very difficult. You have to put down 20 to 40%. You have to have much more documentation of your income, and your interest rate's going to be higher.
Well, so, you know, the industry and the government are looking over there and seeing that, and with that thinking is the thinking that government support is going to be extended.
I don't know if they'll do additional support, but they're definitely not going to roll back the support that they have, you know, in the foreseeable future. I mean, they've kicked the question down of what to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which the government seized last September, down the road. I mean, the administration says they'll issue a report in the first quarter of 2010, but this is such a politically explosive issue on the one hand, and then also on the other hand, it's just a practical issue that they really cannot unwind support for the housing market. So I really don't think, and our story says that there's just no easy exit, and there's just no way that the government is going to get out of the housing market for the foreseeable future.
Wall Street Journal reporter Deborah Solomon. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's the Dizzy Gillespie All-Star Big Band with a ravishing new rendition of one of the all-time standards, I Can't Get Started. But we can, and we will, with a review of some recent jazz releases. And joining us to do that, of course, here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Good to see you as always.
Greetings, Robin Young.
And James, who is responsible for this lovely music? It's not Dizzy Gillespie.
It is lovely, isn't it?
Yet.
Well, this is the Dizzy Gillespie All-Star Big Band from their new disc on the Half Note label called I'm Beboppin' Too. Now, the late trumpeter, composer, vocalist, humorist, bandleader, John Burke's Dizzy Gillespie was, along with his friend and collaborator Charlie Yardbird Parker, one of the avatars of bebop. And there's bebop galore, not to mention lustrous ballads, and lots of fun in this winning set, 17 pieces strong, and they've also got a vocalist at times, Roberta Gamberini. And it's nothing but top-flight musicians, both youngish and oldish. Five of the guys actually played with the ebullient Mr. Gillespie, most notably the multi-reed man and comedic singer James Moody, who was Dizzy's frontline partner for many years.
Yeah, but that was back then. And
yeah,
now it's,
then was then.
It's hard. It's expensive to have a big band now.
Yeah, that's true. But because Gillespie's bread and butter was his small group, and he wrote some originals that had valuable copyrights, at least for jazz, he could from time to time front various editions of his orchestra from 1945 to like 1989. And the big band had a special place in his heart. Let's hear part of trumpeter Roy Hargrove's solo from this version of I Can't Get Started from the new CD by the Gillespie All-Star Big Band. Hargrove is, as Gillespie was, a bravura trumpeter, and those are the hot players whose tones are brilliant and whose runs in the upper register crackle with authority. Listen to Roy Hargrove's restraint, however, as he begins a gorgeous solo on I Can't Get Started with You. Robin, here's a fun fact for you. 1956, Dizzy Gillespie's orchestra. They made an international goodwill tour sponsored by the U.S. State Department. Among the countries they visited and were warmly received, well, let me see if you can guess two of these countries.
56?
Yeah, 1956.
Cuba, Soviet Union.
No.
Cuba and Persia.
You're close, yeah.
Iran?
That's one.
And Cuba. I came back to Cuba.
Pakistan.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Iran and Pakistan.
Yeah, well, you know, times have changed.
Well, we were goodwill ambassadors in the mid-1950s.
And we were welcomed in places
Indeed,
like
we
Iran.
Were.
Right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful tidbit. What's next?
Well, we've got a 37-year-old bassist and composer, and for nearly two decades, he's been widely admired in jazz circles around the world. He is Christian McBride, and his new album on the Mac Avenue label is called Kind of Brown.
Uh-huh, on homage, because of course you remember Miles Davis' Kind of Blue, right?
From 1959. But unlike that 1959 Davis classic, Kind of Brown breaks no new ground. It does groove harder, though, and if tuneful hard bop, swinging blues, and an abiding melodic sensibility appeal to you, no doubt about it, you'll delight in McBride's new disc. This is a sample from the lead track on the album. The tune is called Brother Mister.
Of course, many people know Christian McBride for his playing with Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, Sting, Diana Krall, Pat Metheny.
The list
Metheny,
goes on
right?
and on and
so
on.
So many.
But McBride has also recorded fairly extensively as a leader. In my not-so-humble opinion, Kind of Brown is his best yet, lots of bottoms. Let's go to a McBride solo that sets the tone for a brisk blues by the late trumpeter Freddie Hubbard. Hubbard was yet another outstanding musician with whom McBride worked, in this case not long after coming to New York at age 18. Again, Christian McBride and his quintet, known as Inside Straight, The band features, among others, Steve Wilson on alto saxophone and drummer Carl Allen. And on this number, they conjure the spirit of Blue Note Records style of forward-looking post-bop from the mid-1960s. The tune is Theme for Kareem, Christian McBride.
McBride and Inside Straight from their new CD, Kind of Brown, and we'll have a list of all of James' picks at our website, hereandnow.org. What shall we go out with?
Rob and I thought to take us home, we'd change the musical feeling entirely.
I'm transported to Brazil. I've heard this, perhaps not this way.
Sure you have, Robin. It's Desafinado, and it's one of nine gems composed by the great Antonio Carlos Jobim on pianist Fred Hirsch's new CD for the Sunnyside label. Fred Hirsch plays Antonio Carlos Jobim. One aspect of Jobim's music that has always struck me is how self-contained each of his pieces are. And the thing about Jobim's melodies, and Gershwin's, to cite another obvious example, is that they almost play themselves, these tunes. In other words, well, at least it seems to me that improvisation is almost superfluous, but in the hands of a master pianist like Fred Hirsch, you get two for the price of one. Jobim's theme, followed by Hirsch's variations on that theme. Sometimes he interprets the material as if it were a Chopin nocturne or prelude, sometimes as if it were a sprightly dance. Antonio Carlos Jobim, one of the giants, and Fred Hirsch at the piano, paying homage to Jobim.
James Isaacs, our jazz aficionado, with his jazz picks. James, thanks so much, as always.
As always, Robin, my pleasure.